Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. We'll begin with today's observance by the Palestinians of the 70th anniversary of the Nakba, the catastrophe following violent protests yesterday, which left many dead and wounded from Israeli gunfire, that Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, applauded as, quote, restraint by the Israeli Defense Forces as she vetoed a Security Council resolution calling for a probe into the violence. We'll speak with Heather Hilbert, the director of the New Models of Policy Change Project at the New America Foundation's Political Reform Program. She previously served as a speechwriter for President Clinton and Secretaries of State Albright and Christopher, and was a member of the State Department's policy planning staff. And we will discuss the prayers offered at yesterday's opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem by a racist rabbi and two bigoted anti-Semitic American Christian preachers, and her article at New York Magazine, Status Quo Minuses in Israel and Palestine. Then Khaled El-Gindi, a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, who served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel and is the author of Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Obama, joins us. We will discuss the sharp drop in protest activity today along the Gaza border, perhaps due to a deal Egypt made with Hamas to open its Rafah border crossing to let much-needed food and medical supplies into the besieged and blockaded Gaza Strip. We will assess whether Egypt is acting in concert with the Israelis to temporarily ease the suffering in the crowded outdoor prison of 1.8 million Palestinians controlled by the militant group Hamas, who the U.S. and Israel blame for the deaths yesterday. Then, finally, a leading U.S. political analyst, Bill Schneider, joins us in the studio. He is a visiting professor at UCLA and was CNN's senior political analyst from 1990 to 2009, and his latest book just out is Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. We'll discuss how in a little more than 50 years, American politics has gone from Camelot to Game of Thrones and House of Cards, and how American voters have increasingly placed values over interests and now have elected a leader who most voters, 61%, did not think was qualified to serve as president. And joining us now is Heather Hilbert, who is the director of the New Models of Policy Change Project at the New America Foundation's Political Reform Program. She previously served in the Clinton administration as special assistant and speechwriter to the president, speechwriter for Secretaries of State Albright and Christopher, and a member of the State Department's policy planning staff. And she has an article at New York Magazine, Status Quo Minuses in Israel and Palestine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Heather Hilbert.
Thanks for having me.
And what do you mean by the status quo minuses in Israel and Palestine?
Well, there has been a perception for a while that, I mean, obviously the peace process isn't going anywhere. We aren't near a two-state solution. But there's been a perspective, and this is actually something I quoted from the immediate past ambassador to Israel, Dan Shapiro, that even when sort of something that seems dramatic happened, like the embassy move and the shooting deaths that we've seen in Gaza yesterday and over recent weeks, that nonetheless the situation was stable enough that it would bump along into the foreseeable future without a dramatic uptick in violence. But the minus means you're not making progress toward peace, and maybe people on one or both sides are losing some of the attributes of normal life that they had built up.
Well, interesting enough, the former ambassador to Israel, Dan Shapiro, the former U.S. ambassador you just mentioned, he was in Israel, but he was not invited to the opening ceremonies, there were no Democrats invited. This appeared to be a fairly deliberately partisan affair. What's your understanding? Was it just, I mean, why would they be so highly partisan in this regard and only invite, you know, extremist kind of fundamentalist American so-called Christian preachers, but not a broad representation of America?
So for years, foreign policy in general and Israel policy in particular were very nonpartisan. You know, people always used to say and genuinely believed politics stops at the water's edge. But over, frankly, the last 6 years or so, that maybe going further back, maybe starting during the worst days of the Iraq War, International affairs is now one of the most polarized policy issues in the U.S., and what people think about a number of key issues. Russia is another one that comes to mind. Trade is another one, very much driven by bipartisan identification. So I think what we were seeing was the Trump administration saying, we think there are political benefits to this move. We want to confer those benefits on our allies in the U.S. We don't want any Democrats to get any benefits that they might have from being seen to be at this event. And we can run Israel policy and Middle East policy the way we want it, sort of without, we don't need you. You know, we don't need Democratic votes to do this. We don't need Democratic advice to do it. We don't need the whole country involved. We have our interest groups, and that's all we need. And that, frankly, it's a really dramatic departure for American foreign policy. And the people that it should worry most are actually the friends of Israel, because what it means when one party wraps itself in your issue is that it's going to be enormously tempting for the other party, should it get back in power sometime, to say, okay, now we're going to do a 180-degree turn and we're going to undo everything you did. And no country wants to be on that seesaw of relationship. You know, look what just happened with the Iran deal. So that's the signal that the administration was choosing to send.
Well, they were sending a signal, were they not, to this constituency, often described as Christian Zionists. That would explain why Pastor Hagee and Jeffress were there, surely. And how do you deal with that? Do the Democrats, therefore, are they required to somehow, if the Republicans have activated the Christian right, should they therefore activate the Democrats, the Christian left?
Let's be clear. The Christian right's been activated in American politics for quite a while, and the president doesn't deserve any particular credit for that. You know, the point I would make, if you think about sort of the core values issues that have been sort of the top tier evangelical interests for some time, those issues are A, not really getting anywhere in this administration, and B, they're taking a rhetorical beating and being made to look kind of ridiculous, as you have a president in office who's subject to multiple accusations of having affairs and assaulting women and disrespecting women, members of Congress who are sort of prominent Christian conservatives who get caught forcing their mistresses to have abortions. It's been a very embarrassing year plus for the things that are nominally at the top of the Christian rights agenda. But here is something that we can do for the Christian right, that seems, and when you import pastors, which, by the way, we'll come back to that in a second, but that's just a truly shocking and astonishing thing that happened and that the Israeli government was comfortable with it. But what you're signaling to the Christian right, you know, just keep ignoring the way that we flout the values that you profess each and every day, because look, here we're delivering on a different core promise. You know, just forget about abortion and family values and the sanctity of marriage, but we'll give you this other thing.
And again, I'm speaking with Heather Hilbert, who's the director of the New Models of Policy Change Project, the New America Foundation's political reform program. She previously served in the Clinton administration as special assistant and speechwriter to the president, speechwriter for Secretaries of State Albright and Christopher, and a member of the State Department's policy planning staff. And she has an article in New York Magazine, Status Quo Minuses in Israel and Palestine. But the theology, if you could call it that, that the so-called Christian Zionists bring to the Israelis is absolutely mystifying why they would have any dealings whatsoever with them. But apparently, going back, I think, quite a number of years, they made a calculus that these people were sort of zealously loyal to Israel, but only in a very narrow and somewhat spiritually pornographic sense. They want Israel to trigger Armageddon. And that is essentially their interest in Israel, and it's a bad deal for the Israelis, because only 144,000 get raptured up from the Mount of Olives before they're instantly converted to Christianity, and the rest, like you and me, we end up in the lake of fire. So surely the Israelis must be aware of this obsession and this weird interpretation of the Book of Revelations, which has been the result of Pastor Hagee and all of the and Jeffries. That's been their main issue at the pulpit, and they've all written books. The Left Behind series were among the top-selling books in U.S. publishing history. So this is quite a phenomenon. So it surely hasn't escaped the attention of the Israelis what the real belief system is.
Well, I think it's a useful reminder that the Israeli embrace of the Christian right comes when to try to use the Christian right to counter the influence of the oil industry within the Republican Party back when the oil industry was perceived as very pro-Middle Eastern Arab regimes and thus perceived as somewhat anti-Israel. So to the Israelis, that alliance made sense in terms of having a strong foothold in both parties. And over time, as the current government of Israel, which has been in power since 2009, or Benjamin Netanyahu has been prime minister since 2009, with coalition governments that have moved steadily to the right, and the sort of codependency where there are considerable infusions of cash into Israeli conservative media and Israeli politics from American sources has caused the conservative leaders that Netanyahu depends on to support his government to be willing to make their peace with the kind of ridiculous anti-Semitism of Hagers and Jefferson and some of the others, because it comes with bags of money and resources from various U.S. sources. The other point, which I think is not well understood in the U.S., because frankly the spectacle of our own politics is so mesmerizing right now, but Israeli politics also in recent years have taken a turn toward the sensationalist and right-wing and really problematically ethno-nationalist. So to the extent that one of the rabbis at the ceremony at the embassy yesterday was a gentleman who has been quoted calling Africans monkeys and calling on Israel to throw all migrants and refugees out of the country. So you can see that there are a number of lines of thought about sort of what kind of nationalism and how a country composes its own citizenship and understands and defends its idea of itself, that the hard Israeli right and the hard American right, including its evangelical component, really have in common. And there's almost a live and let live quality about it, which I find difficult to understand, but it's a well developed phenomenon, and as I say, the level of toxicity in Israeli politics is right at home with what Americans are now sadly used to hearing from our far right voices.
Yeah, but from your point of view, Heather Hilbert, as one who's worked in the State Department and for secretaries of state, this is America on the world stage doing something that's extremely controversial that no other country has done, and moving their embassy to Jerusalem. And it was considered provocative, and people, you know, not only did other countries warn about it, they also, of course, warned about pulling out of the Iran deal, both of which, by the way, the Iran deal and the move of the U.S. embassy have propelled Netanyahu up in the polls. The Israelis consider him a real hero because they give him credit for convincing Trump to pull out of the JCPOA and also moving the embassy. So that's preceded this move. But the display that you're talking about, where you don't have any Democrats, all you have is representatives from a kind of rabid fringe part of American Christendom with their peculiar theology, and with a background and a record of some appalling anti-Semitic and bigoted statements. Hagee, for example, called Hitler a half-Jew and said that both Hitler and the Holocaust were God's plan to return the Jews to Israel. And, of course, the second part of that, which goes unsaid, is, and then once the Jews return to Zion and the comet streaks the sky and all that crazy stuff in the Book of Revelation, then you have this glorious end of the world where, as again I say, you and I we end up in the lake of fire. In other words, our deaths precipitate their eternal life. I find that really offensive.
Well, as the granddaughter and great-granddaughter and great-great-granddaughter of ministers, I have to say I feel fairly confident that they're the ones who are going to be disappointed when we all get to find out what it is that comes next. But a couple more serious things I want to say about the diplomacy. One is that Israel is, and just listeners should know that Israel is a very polarized country like the U.S. and Netanyahu is wildly unpopular because he has a number of corruption cases proceeding against him, and he's perceived to have been fairly ineffective in tackling Israeli economic and social challenges, never mind the peace process. So he does these things, and it's exactly that's what pulls up support from his base and enables him to stay in office. But Americans should understand that he's not a broadly popular figure. It's horribly offensive to me as an American who thinks of myself as knowing something about diplomacy that you would send these individuals abroad on my tax dollars to represent the amazing wealth of diversity and tradition of relations among Christians, Muslims, and Jews, that you would send these people out to represent that. Second point is, as you said, most of our allies around the world boycotted this event, did not attend. None of our big allies did. None of Israel's neighbors did. There are, 190 some countries in the world. There were 32 countries that attended the event at our embassy, and possibly the two biggest economies that were represented there were the Czech Republic and Serbia. So, this wasn't exactly greeted with great support from around the world. And indeed, at least two countries have subsequently pulled their ambassadors out of Israel to protest both the embassy move and the excessive, extreme use of violence by the Israelis on protesters in Gaza. So, this move, it both manages to implicate the U.S., more deeply in violence and problems in the region and reduce our standing to be able to do anything constructive about it. So you really don't often see a power shoot itself in an appendage quite as dramatically as we just did.
Just in the last minute, in your article, Status Quo Minuses in Israel and Palestine, Heather Herbert, you mentioned that the support for Israel still exists amongst older Democrats. It's worth noting that 2/3 to 3/4 of American Jewry do vote Democratic, even though an enormous amount of support is coming from wealthy Jewish Americans like Adelson and others, but that the younger Americans are twice as likely as their elders to be more sympathetic with the Palestinians than the Israelis. And, of course, that has happened in Europe previously. There's been a shift from affection to Israel during the 60s and 70s. There was enormous affection for Israel in Europe, but now that's switched to the Palestinians. So where do you see that trajectory going in this country?
Well, there are two trends that are pushing in the same direction. And one is, as you say, younger Jewish Americans who are every bit as liberal Democratic voting as their parents, are much more comfortable being critical of the state of Israel. Don't see their Jewish identity tied up with an unquestioning support of what Israel does. And indeed, there were young religious Jews protesting in Washington yesterday, which was an interesting development that you certainly wouldn't have seen 20 or 30 years ago. So you have that happening at the same time that younger Americans as a whole are just much less keyed into the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and its importance, much less likely to see it as a centrally important problem for American foreign policy. And, a comment that I often make is that the opposite of love is not so much hate as indifference. And the place, and I mean, you can see this with the Trump administration, that when the administration doesn't feel like it needs a bone to throw its Christian Zionist allies, it hasn't really devoted an awful lot of attention to the very serious problems there, hasn't made, Jared Kushner notwithstanding, you haven't seen an enormous amount of energy go into the problem. And frankly, you saw the Obama administration somewhat downgrade the attention previous administrations had placed on trying to get to a deal. So you know, over the long term, there's going to be less and less American willingness to engage in the problem of peacemaking, even as actions like this make us more and more complicit in how difficult and dangerous it is for the inhabitants of the region.
Well, Heather Hurlbut, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Heather Hurlbut, who's the director of the New Models of Policy Change Project at the New America Foundation's Political Reform Program. She previously served in the Clinton administration as special assistant and speechwriter to President Clinton and speechwriter to the Secretaries of State Albright and Christopher. And she was a member of the State Department's policy planning staff. And she has an article at New York Magazine, Status Quo Minuses in Israel and Palestine. We can take a brief station break. We're back looking into the sharp drop in process today in Gaza Strip, perhaps due to the deal Egypt made with Hamas to open its Rafah boarding crossing, its Rafah border crossing.
وهويتك وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فقط حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق امنيتك رصد السيارة وهويتك وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فكرت حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق امنيتك انسرقنا من ارضنا بلدنا غلبنا عحالين قلبنا اقنعونا وتدربنا نحمي اسرائيل من حالنا صرنا ممسوكين عساكر وين ما كان بسول يقول هاد لمين وين 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 الملايين وين الملايين اللي بدنا تحرر فلسطين.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Halid El-Gindi, who's a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. His latest book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians, From Balfour to Obama. Welcome to Background Briefing, Halid El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
And today things were considerably quieter on the border with Israel and Gaza. Obviously, yesterday there was the worst violence seen since 2014. 60 people were killed, 2,700 injured, and coinciding, of course, with celebrations at Jerusalem at the opening of the U.S. embassy. And I think in part, the easing of tensions may have something to do with the Egyptians opening up the Rafah border crossing with Gaza for 4 days, starting on Saturday with Sunday, and of course Monday, the day of all the casualties, and today, Tuesday. And apparently a lot of the wounded have been able to get medical treatment across on the other side of the Rafah crossing in Egypt. People have been, 1.8 million Palestinians have been bottled up, and obviously in dire conditions. I think it's considered the most crowded place on the earth. Do you see a connection there, Halid, between the Egyptians opening up the border, letting food and medicine in, and perhaps doing this in coordination with the Israelis to ease tensions a little?
That's certainly a possibility. In the past, Egypt, as well as the Israelis, have, whenever there have been flare-ups or unrest in Gaza, there have been measures taken to ease some of the restrictions and allow food and medicine, as you said, or allow people and goods to cross back and forth. But these are really band-aid remedies to a much bigger problem. A series of problems, really, in Gaza, where life has essentially become unlivable, according to UN officials. The water is undrinkable. It's polluted by seawater and sewage. You have massive unemployment. and real shortage of basic foods and medicines, and real dire conditions financially and from a humanitarian perspective. And that is sort of the backdrop for these protests, which are both a way to highlight the plight of Palestinian refugees, which has been neglected, an issue that's really been neglected by both the peace process and by Palestinian leaders for a long time, and the ongoing blockade of Gaza. So Gazans, I think, most of whom are, in fact, refugees or descendants of refugees, are sort of doubly neglected in terms of their conditions. And so these marches have kind of put the plight of Palestinians in Gaza front and center on the international agenda.
So most of the reporting that I've seen in the last couple of days on CBS and NBC and CNN with the correspondents there amidst all of the smoke and the rock throwing and the bullets flying and people being hit by bullets, one of the themes that seemed to come out of these reports was that these young Gazans, whether they're being sort of manipulated by Hamas or not, that seems to be the narrative that's coming from the U.S. and particularly from Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., who applauded today Israel's restraint in the face of these protesters, blaming the deaths on Hamas at the same time as vetoing a U.N. Security Council resolution to investigate the killings. But what was said often by these correspondents was, having talked to these young people who were literally facing Israeli live fire, that they had nothing to lose, that that was the attitude, that living in Gaza is a sort of slow death, so they're not afraid of a quick death, in other words.
Yeah, I've heard those same stories, and they're quite compelling, and I think it really does illustrate the desperation that so many people in Gaza feel. You know, Gaza is a very tiny space. It's as you said, one of the most densely populated areas in the world, and you have an entire generation, and most of the population is under the age of 30. You have an entire generation that has never left the Gaza Strip. They've never even been to other Palestinian areas like the West Bank, much less Jerusalem, and they've never left overseas. And as we discussed, the conditions in Gaza are so dire. So it's not surprising that so many young people who have no employment opportunities, who feel this sense of despair, feel that they have nothing left to lose. It's quite telling, actually, because the conditions in Gaza are entirely man-made. This is not, you know, the humanitarian catastrophe that exists in Gaza is not a result of a hurricane or an earthquake or some other natural disaster, but it is entirely man-made. It is essentially the product of politics, and in some cases failed politics. It's an Israeli policy of inertia and neglect in which they've, in an attempt to isolate Hamas, have besieged the entire population of 2 million human beings. And it's also, I think, a function of a failed and dysfunctional Palestinian leadership, whether it's the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank under Mahmoud Abbas or the leadership, the de facto rulers of Gaza, Hamas. Both, you know, that division has really hurt the Palestinians, particularly in Gaza. And the continuation of this desperate situation is very much also a product of this Palestinian dysfunction, as well as Israeli policy.
So when the U.S. and Israel blames everything on Hamas, and the Israelis claim that they're amidst these young protesters who were shot down, along with children and women, there also were, according to the Israeli military, Hamas fighters who snuck in and threw grenades, etc., and were shot. So blaming it on Hamas leads you to, you just talked about the dysfunction of and the divisions in Palestinian politics with Fatah, led by an aging leader who's made some unfortunate anti-Semitic remarks recently and seems to, by all accounts, to have totally failed. And then on the other side, Hamas is a religiously based, I believe it's a theocratically based kind of movement. Hamas means zeal in Arabic. So is there any way, is there another generation here of young Palestinians who's disgusted with both Hamas and Fatah? I mean, I would assume that has to be the case. You just said divided and failed leadership. I think that seems like an understatement.
It is. There is actually a groundswell of frustration among Palestinians, particularly young Palestinians, but not exclusively, and particularly in Gaza, where they feel most abandoned by their leaders. And you see that also, I think, a similar sentiment reflected around the region. And like elsewhere in the region, that sentiment has not yet been translated into a political movement or organization that can actually have an impact on politics and on internal politics or on the relations of Palestinians to others around the world. So, you know, you do have this frustration that exists, but it's not organized and it's not ideologically or organizationally coherent yet. It hasn't quite matured. I would, you know, it's similar to, if people recall back in 2011, the Tahrir Square protests and the Arab Spring, where there was this, you know, there was this groundswell of opposition to the regimes and eventually toppled regimes. But what came to power afterward were essentially old guard forces. The Islamists, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and of course the military. So these were the established political forces in the country, and the newly emerging forces hadn't yet matured. And I think that's also true in the case of the Palestinians. And we're looking at really, I think, a generational shift. So this turmoil that is happening in the region is something that is likely to continue for several years before, you know, before we begin to see a light at the end of the tunnel, or some kind of new political force that is maybe more democratic or maybe more representative of the people's wishes and interests. But this is a long-term process, and it's not something that's going to change overnight.
Well, Khaled El-Gindi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, who's a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations. And his latest book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians, From Balfour to Obama. We're going to take a brief station break and back, joined in the studio by Bill Snyder, the former senior political analyst at CNN and the author of the new book just out, Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. Lo, Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now in the studio is Bill Schneider, a leading U.S. political analyst and a professor at the Shah School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. He is a visiting professor at UCLA and has been a visiting professor at Brandeis University and Boston College, and is the co-author with Seymour Martin Lipset of The Confidence Gap, and was CNN's senior political analyst from 1990 to 2009. And his latest book just out is Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Schneider.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So the book traces 50 years of American politics, from Camelot to the Game of Thrones, or I would even add to that the House of Cards. So what happened between Camelot and the Game of Thrones?
Well, we had a transformation in this country. It used to be that politics was about conflicts of interest between business and labor and other kinds of interests. And conflicts of interest can be negotiated. They can be compromised. But in the last 50 years, they've turned into conflicts of values between the left and the right. Values are matters of right and wrong, and they're very difficult to negotiate or compromise. So therefore, the system has really broken down because different parties have different bases in different parts of government. Things have gone into gridlock in this country. And it's interesting. In other countries like Britain, gridlock is unconstitutional. You can't have gridlock. If a British government can't govern, then they just shut it down and they have another election until they elect a government that can govern. Here in the United States, we're okay with gridlock. It can go on for decades.
So we went from Jack Kennedy's Camelot, albeit cut short, to a situation where on November 2016, the American people elected a president of the United States who most voters, 61%, did not think was qualified to serve as president. And we are living with the consequences. But I was just watching the rally that Trump had in Indiana. And you look at the faces of those people, they love him. He loves these rallies. And then so you cut from that to MSNBC, where you think that any moment Trump is going to be dragged out of the Oval Office, either in a straitjacket or an orange jumpsuit. So there are these two realities and two universes in this country now. And liberals, I don't think, understand, looking at those faces, the affection that they have. Trump supporters see him as their deliverance.
And they are his base. Your base in politics is the people who are with you when you're wrong. In politics, you're going to be wrong sooner or later. Ronald Reagan had Iran-Contra. Bill Clinton had the Monica Lewinsky affair. There's got to be someone who says, or a constituency that says, we don't approve of what you did, but you know what? We're still with you. We're still your supporters. Well, a lot of people who support Donald Trump support him through thick and thin, and they're going to stick with him. It's maybe a quarter of the electorate. It's not a majority. He didn't win with the majority. In fact, he didn't win even a plurality of the vote. He did it by the rules. He won by the rules because of the Electoral College. But he's got a base, and they are determined to stay with him because they believe he brings them respect, which they didn't think they were getting. They don't think they're getting from other politicians and particularly from Democrats.
But he's also obviously tailoring his politics and indeed his foreign policy to this constituency, and particularly just in Israel, where you had the contrast between the beaming smiles of Ivanka Trump opening the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem and Palestinians being shot down in droves. And then you had these two so-called Christian ministers representing American Christendom, yeah. Both of whom have made some appalling anti-Semitic remarks along with calling the Catholic faith the work of Satan. That would explain to me that these also, the Christian right coalition is being pampered as well, or handed to.
Well, you know, Donald Trump is not a deeply religious man, nor was Ronald Reagan. Reagan brought the evangelicals into politics, and Donald Trump is satisfying them by endorsing their positions on issues like abortion and other climate change, other issues that evangelicals believe in. They are part of his base now. You don't have to be one of them. You just have to do what they want you to do. And Donald Trump is delivering what they want. And that is a base that is militantly pro-Israel. You know, it is a strange thing that today you find anti-Semitism, as you always have, on the right, and anti-Israel sentiment on the left. And poor Jewish voters, they don't know what side to go on.
But we do have, if you look at how much his foreign policy seems to be pandering to this base, you put it, you know, maybe a quarter. It's, you know, roughly around 40%, at least in terms of his popularity.
It's those who approve of him. I call his base the people who don't just approve of him, but they're going to stand right with him no matter what.
And there's no question that all of the promises, no matter how absurd, like building a wall that he made in his campaign, a lot of politicians running for president. In fact, FDR said you have two kind of people in politics, those that get you elected and those that help you govern. Well, he's never gotten to part two. And it would seem that going back to the 61% of Americans who disapproved of him, didn't think he was qualified, we have a tyranny of the minority, do we not?
Well, we do. The Trump base is with him. And he's catering them to them endlessly. You know, he has a strange relationship with conservatives. His policies are very hardline conservative, probably the most conservative president we've really ever had. But it's not because of his base. It's because he made a deal with conservatives and Republicans. He doesn't come out of their part of the party. That's George and Jeb Bush. He made a deal with them. You support me for president, and I'll deliver what you want. And we're waiting for that breach between Trump and the conservatives to open up. It's beginning to show on the issue of trade, because the conservatives in the Republican Party are free traders, and Trump violates free trade all the time. That's the beginning of an opening between Trump and the right.
And you think that that opening is going to be exacerbated by bailing out this Chinese company?
That's another one. He is helping a Chinese company because he made a deal. American agricultural interests, farmers, were extremely unhappy when he cut off trade relations with China and other countries, because they need those countries, those markets, to sell their goods. So Trump made a deal with them. He made a deal really with a Chinese company and said, you'll be exempt from the high tariffs, and that will satisfy American agriculture because I need those people to vote for me. He does very well in rural areas. It's kind of unimaginable. Here's a guy from Queens who lives in Midtown Manhattan, whose best states were Wyoming, Tennessee, and West Virginia. That's a real change. The Republican Party has always been the party of the country club. Trump's constituency is the party of country people.
Well, but that also ties in, does it not, with the Electoral College and this peculiar paradox in American politics, where more and more people are moving to the cities and into the blue states, and populations, mostly educated urban populations, are being concentrated, whereas the rural part of the country is being thinned out. But all of those states have two senators, and the trajectory we're on is that the Republicans will be able to control most of the Senate in perpetuity, unless I think the Democrats are bold enough to make D.C. statehood, Puerto Rico statehood. There's even talk of breaking up California. What do you think about that?
Breaking up California?
Well, either the idea that the trend of the depopulated rural states having more power in the Senate, whereas the populated blue states with concentrations in the cities, even though they get the popular vote, they won't get the Electoral College vote necessarily.
So, here's a good example. California is 67 times larger than Wyoming, but each state gets two senators. California has two Democrats. Wyoming has two Republicans. Well, that sort of discrepancy is part of our constitutional order. In fact, here's something a lot of people don't know. Into the original Constitution, there is a provision that says there's only one part of the Constitution that can never be amended. That is the part that guarantees every state two senators. It creates equal representation from all the states. Now, a lot of the tiny states by population are now Republican states. There are a few that are Democratic, like Rhode Island, which votes consistently Democratic, but I think more of them, like Idaho and Wyoming, send Republicans to the Senate. Why is that in the Constitution? Well, there's a good reason for that, or there is a reason. I would say it's a good reason. The slave states. They insisted when the Constitution was written that their say in American government be protected, and to do that, they had to be guaranteed equal state representation in the United States Senate, because they knew full well that as the country grew, there would be more free states admitted than slave states. It was, like many things in our system of government, designed to protect slavery.
And again, Bill Snyder has joined us in the studio. He's a leading U.S. political analyst and a professor at the Shah School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. He's also a visiting professor at UCLA and has also been a visiting professor at Brandeis University and Boston College, and is a co-author with Seymour Martin Lipsick of The Confidence Gap, and was CNN's senior political analyst from 1990 to 2009. And his latest book just out is Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. There's something else that's gone under the radar. In the Constitution, there's a provision, Convention of the States. And believe it or not, the Koch brothers and other powerful plutocrats in this country have organized a move through the state legislatures to sign them all up. You only have to get to two-thirds majority then to invoke a constitutional convention. And then essentially you can rewrite the Constitution from page one, from a blank sheet of paper. They're within three or four states of pulling that off.
Yes. They were, I think, very close to getting a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution passed through both houses of Congress. I think that's unlikely to pass. Constitutional convention is a bit scary because they can do anything they want. And lots of groups like gun groups and anti-abortion groups, all kinds of constituencies can show up. Some people say you can limit a constitutional convention to one subject, like the Electoral College. A lot of people, particularly Democrats, want to get rid of the Electoral College. But most constitutional experts say once you have a constitutional convention, which we have not had since the original constitutional convention in the 1780s, if we have a constitutional amendment, it can't be limited by subject. They can change anything they want in the Constitution. The Electoral College, not equal representation in the Senate, the Supreme Court won't allow that. That's in the original Constitution. But they can change anything they want. They can have anti-abortion amendments. They can have anything they want in the Constitution, and that would be true chaos.
Well, I bring it up because of the question would be in the transition, this 50-year transition from Camelot to the Game of Thrones or House of Cards, money certainly has been a factor. I recall that in the last interview that Senator Ted Kennedy did on NPR, he said, you know, they asked him, what was the biggest change you saw in your long Senate career? And he said, the biggest change is money. We don't work anymore. We used to work 5 days a week. Now we work maybe Tuesday and Wednesday, and then Thursday and Friday we're back to our district, and we come back on Monday, and we spend all of our days dialing for dollars. In effect, our politicians have become telemarketers. Is that a part of this transition?
Well, it's certainly true, and many people who go to Congress don't like it because they have to spend all their time raising money and catering to moneyed interests. That's a very difficult thing to do, and that's why so many of them retire. I'm not sure what can be done about that because the Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled that restrictions on fundraising and on spending in campaigns, those restrictions cannot be enforced. So that's one of the requirements of modern politics today, and politics tends to follow the money.
Well, I'm just trying to get a sense, and I know your book really does explore this territory, and that's why it is so important, Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. But I wonder, as a sort of liberal or progressive or whatever I'm supposed to be, mm-hmm. both of them are dirty words mm-hmm. in our political lexicon, I wonder what happened to liberalism and progressivism in this country just in the recent era. Because you talk about back in the 60s, Camelot. Well, it would seem if you even go up to the 70s and up to through Jimmy Carter, the Democrats in the House and Senate, they had enormous majorities. They had enormous majorities on the Supreme Court, where you actually had real liberals like William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall. So what happened? Did they lose heart? Because it seems like starting in the 1980s, they've been in retreat and on the defensive.
Well, yes. Really starting in the 1960s with Richard Nixon, what began to happen was the defection of large numbers of traditional Democrats, white working class Democrats. They defected from the Democratic Party, and over the years they became Republicans. Some of them voted for Barry Goldwater in the South in 1964 because of civil rights. Then they voted for George Wallace, who not only carried some southern states but had a lot of support from so-called Archie Bunker voters. I'm aging myself. My students never don't know who that is. But they got support from what we used to call Archie Bunker voters. And then, of course, Richard Nixon used his southern strategy to fold them into the Republican Party. So what's happened is you've had a lot of white voters, southern whites, northern urban ethnics, who left the Democratic Party. They were once the party's base. and they have eventually become Republicans, and they're really Trump's base at this point. It's been a remarkable transition because those voters have just changed politics forever completely. And Democrats really don't know how to get them back. But Trump is their hero right now. And when you ask them, as I have, why do they support Donald Trump so much? They say, because he respects us. The Democrats don't respect us. Let me give you a good example. West Virginia. West Virginia used to be a solid New Deal Democratic state. It's a poor state. It's overwhelmingly white. And it's a state of coal miners. They were strong union supporters. And Robert Byrd, the late majority leader in the Senate, was the leading Democrat in West Virginia for many decades. Now West Virginia has turned solidly Republican, and it's a base state for Donald Trump. It's overwhelmingly Republican. It started voting Republican for George W. Bush in 2000, and with each election since then, it's become more and more and more Republican. I think it was Donald Trump's second best state in 2016.
But this transition is also goes in parallel with the loss of power and influence of American labor unions, which in the 50s were about, 50% or 30, between 30 and 50%, I think, of the labor market was unionized. Now it's down to about 7%. And there's an assault on public employee unions as well, and a couple of important cases at the Supreme Court that could defund the public employees' unions. And as you know, there's also these right-to-work efforts across the country. Many, many states are moving in that direction. So labor's in retreat. And that was always certainly a big factor in funding the Democratic Party in the 60s and 70s. So that has to be a component in this.
Oh, yes. The weakening of labor unions has been a major component. Democrats were once the party of organized labor. Now you have to say the Democrats have become the party of the universities. And they have believe in diversity and inclusion. That's what holds Democrats together today. The difference between the parties used to be essentially based on wealth. Now it's really more on education. Democrats represent the educated elite. The party of organized labor is now the party of the universities. And Republicans have been Trumpified. They've embraced populist cultural values, racial backlash, isolationism in foreign policy, religious fundamentalism, values that the educated elite consider unenlightened and even vulgar. There's been a real populist reversal. I write about this in the book. Democrats used to be the populist party, and Republicans were the elitist party when populism was defined by economic interests. Now populism is defined by conservative social values. Democrats have become the elitist party. Republicans are now the populist party. And Trump is, of course, by nature, a populist as well as a conservative.
So could you make the cynical observation that people like Betsy DeVos moving education, taking funds out of public education, putting them into more religious and private charter schools, etc., will continue what must be a trend in and is a trend that we are becoming a less educated population in general. And I recall during the election that Donald Trump says, "I love the poorly educated."
One of the most remarkable things about the 2016 campaign is that it introduced education as a cleavage in American popular and political life. And that cleavage has been there for some time, but it's become larger and larger. And Trump, I was there when Trump said after the Nevada caucuses, "I love the poorly educated." He should, because white poorly educated voters have voted for Trump consistently or supported him consistently, and they're about now 3-1 Trump supporters, and they're not going to leave him. Well, that's important. Let me tell you what's going on. Right now, the wealthier you are, the more likely you are to be a Republican. That's traditional. But what's changed is the better educated you are, the more likely you are to be a Democrat. So I always say that to students, and someone raises his or her hand and says, "Wait a minute, what if you're wealthy and well-educated?" Then my answer is you're cross-pressured. That's what sociologists call it. That means you're pulled in different directions. If you're wealthy and well-educated, if you vote your economic interests, you're going to vote for the Republican, like Mitt Romney, who could be president of any country club. If you vote your cultural values and you're well-educated, you're going to vote Democratic. That was Barack Obama, who represented the well-educated. I used to call Romney the Prince of Wealth, and Obama, the prince of education. And that really defines the difference between the parties these days. And Trump has a very solid base among his favorite constituency, the poorly educated.
Well, just in closing, though, does that mean that because American education is in a downward spiral, and I mentioned, you know, the religious schools, I mean, after all, teaching creationism is by definition sort of anti-science and anti-intellectual. And also one of the biggest disgraces in our government is the for-profit college racket, where $32 billion of taxpayer money subsidizes a bunch of these bottom feeders who basically give kids a worthless diploma and a lifetime of debt. And that's just an absolute disgrace. And we know students should be centers of investment, but now they become centers of profit. And so if you accept my thesis, that would indicate to me that Donald Trump and his ilk will rule this country in perpetuity because Americans are getting less and less educated.
I'm not sure I agree with that entirely. I think public education is definitely in trouble and has been for some time because those who can afford it, mostly whites who are higher income, they are removing their children from the public education system and they're leaving it to other basically it's become like a public charity. You know, something interesting about the United States. We were the first country in the world to have mass public education, and we're the last country in the world to have public health care for all Americans. It's a very strange thing. Americans are actually becoming better educated. The percentage of Americans with college degrees is actually going up slowly over the years. It's now about half of the population that goes to college, and that's become a bigger and bigger political division in the United States between the haves and the have-nots in terms of you have a good, solid education with a college degree and you don't have a real education. That division is very, very big.
Well, Bill Schneider, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been joined in the studio by Bill Schneider, who's a leading U.S. political analyst and a professor at the Shah School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. He is a visiting professor at UCLA and has been a visiting professor at Brandeis University and Boston College, and is the co-author with Seymour Martin Lipset of The Confidence Gap, and was CNN's senior political analyst from 1990 to 2009. And his latest book just out is Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.